To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to let us know what you think of our show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more info at 430-9722. We hope you all had a wonder-filled solstice this past Wednesday and that your Christmas is happy tomorrow. In light of these two holidays, we bring you a song by Dar Williams, The Christians and the Pagans.
Your uncle said we're up here for the holiday. Jane and I were having solstice, now we need a place to stay. And her Christ-loving uncle watched his wife hang Mary on a tree. He watched his son hang candy canes all made with red dye number 3. He told his niece it's Christmas Eve, I know our life is not your style. She said Christmas is like solstice and we miss you and it's been a while. So the Christians and the pagans sat together at the table, finding faith and common ground the best that they were able. Just before the meal was served, hands were held and prayers were said, sending hope for peace on earth to all their gods and goddesses. The food was great, the tree plugged in, the meal had gone without a hitch, till Timmy turned to Amber and said, is it true that you're a witch? His mom jumped up and said, the pies are burning, and she hit the kitchen, and it was Jane who spoke. She said, it's true, your cousin's not a Christian. But we love trees, we love the snow, the friends we have, the world we share, and you find magic from your God, and we find magic everywhere. So the Christians and the pagans sat together at the table, finding faith and common ground, the best that they were able. Where does magic come from? I think magic's in the learning. Cause now when Christians sit with pagans, only pumpkin pies are burning. When Amber tried to do the dishes, her aunt said, really, no, don't bother. Amber's uncle saw how Amber looked like him and like her father. He thought about his brother, how they hadn't spoken in a year. He thought he'd call him up and say, it's Christmas and your daughter's here. He thought of father's sons and brothers, saw his own son tug his sleeve, saying, can I be a pagan? Dad said, we'll discuss it when they leave. So the Christians and the pagans sat together at the table, finding faith and common ground, the best that they were able. Lighting trees in darkness, learning Lewis from the old, and making sense of history and drawing warmth out of the cold.
In 1914, on Christmas Day, just after midnight, a majority of German troops engaged in World War I called a ceasefire and commenced to sing Christmas carols. They approached the armies of the other side, and here is a song called Christmas in the Trenches by Charlie King and Karen Brando telling that story.
Oh, my name is Francis Tolliver, I come from Liverpool. 4 years ago, the war was waiting for me after school. To Belgium and to Flanders, to Germany to hear, I fought for king and country I love dear. 'Twas Christmas in the trenches, where the frost so bitter hung. The frozen fields of France were still, no Christmas song was sung. Our families back in England were toasting us that day. They're brave and glorious lads so far away. I was lying with my messmate on the cold and rocky ground, when across the lines of battle came a most peculiar sound. Says I, "Now listen up, me boys, each soldier strained to hear, as one young German voice sang out so clear. He's singing bloody well, you know," my messmate says to me. Soon one by one each German voice joined in harmony. The cannons rested silent, the gas clouds rolled no more, as Christmas brought us respite from the war. As soon as he was finished and a reverent pause was spent, "God rest ye merry gentlemen," struck up our lads from Kent. The next they sang was "Stealin' Not, 'Tis Silent Night," says I. And in two tongues one song filled up that sky. "There's someone coming towards us," the frontline sentry cried. All sights were fixed on one lone figure trudging from their side. His truce flag, like the Christmas star, shone on that plain so bright, as he bravely strode unarmed into the night. Then one by one on either side stepped into no man's land, with neither gun nor bayonet we met there hand to hand. We shared some secret brandy, and we wished each other well, and in a flare-lit soccer game we gave 'em hell. We traded chocolates, cigarettes, photographs from home, sons and fathers far away from families of our own. Young Sanders played his squeeze box, and they had a violin, this curious and unlikely band of men. Soon daylight stole upon us, sad farewells we each began to settle back to war. But the question haunted every heart that lived that wondrous night: whose family have I fixed within my sight? 'Twas Christmas in the trenches, where the frost so bitter hung. Frozen fields of France were warmed as songs of peace were sung. For the walls they'd placed between us to exact the work of war had crumbled and were gone forevermore. Francis Tolliver, in Liverpool I dwell. Each Christmas comes since World War I, I've learned its lessons well, that the ones who call the shots won't be among the dead and lame, and on each end of the rifle we're the same.
This is Making Waves on WSCA 106.1 FM. That was Christmas in the Trenches by Charlie King and Karen Brandaugh.
Many of us have been doing a lot of shopping as of late. And next we have a story about Walmart's severe exploitation in China. Charles Kernighan speaks on the findings of a 4-year investigation into a Walmart factory in southern China where child labor, forced overtime work, and abuse are everyday occurrences.
Tuesday morning after, it is 8:05 on this Tuesday morning. Just in time for Christmas, the National Labor Committee, along with China Labor Watch, released a comprehensive report on abuses of workers of Walmart in China. Walmart is now the largest retailer in the world. Its revenues in 2002 alone hit 245 billion U.S. Workers in China sweatshops were paid 34 cents an hour, according to this report. On the phone with us is the director of the National Labor Committee, Charles Kernighan. He is joining us from New York City. Charles Kernighan, good morning, and thank you for being with us today.
Hey, good morning. It's great to be here.
Can you provide us with a short summary, or rather a summary, of the findings of this report?
Well, it didn't shock us, but we looked at one particular factory, I think unprecedented. We looked at the Liangcheng toy factory in the south of China, big factory, 3,000 workers. We watched it for the last 4 years. Walmart's been producing there, remote-controlled toy trucks, radio-controlled toy trucks. And over that 4-year period, Walmart did absolutely nothing to improve conditions or guarantee respect for worker rights. So, in fact, the workers were working from 8 o'clock in the morning until 9 o'clock at night, 13 hours a day. This was routine. They would do this 6 and 7 days a week. They'd be at the factory up to 91 hours a week. They'd be working up to 77 hours a week. Workers were being paid, like you mentioned, below the legal minimum wage in China, which is 41 cents an hour in the south of China. That's already below subsistence level wages. They paid these workers 34, 33 cents. They were forced to work off the clock at 10 o'clock. They had to punch their time cards out and then continue working off the clock. So we really don't know how many exact hours they worked. The workers told us they were forced to work often to midnight, sometimes to 1, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. Women were denied their maternity benefits, which would be 3 months leave with pay. Workers had no statutory holidays. Workers didn't get paid leave to get married or to bury dead family members. They had absolutely no rights. They were working in the spray paint department. It's almost impossible to imagine. But when they painted the bodies of these toy cars, women would have to do 2,000 trucks a day. That's one every 250 every hour, one every 14.4 seconds, just relentless. And the workers were paid 18 cents. For every truck they assembled. We bought one of these trucks in Walmart for $64.97, meaning the wages came to just 0.3% of the retail price. They had no union. They had no rights. They live in a state of terror. They're housed in primitive dormitories. They're fed food all the workers describe as awful. They talk about just complete exhaustion. Their lives have no meaning. They live to work. This is what we see in factories producing for Walmart. This is like a concrete image of what's going on all across China.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that Walmart did not change their practices throughout the investigation. I'm wondering what exactly, in what context the investigation was taking place in terms of were any worker, as we have seen in the case of in Central America with other sweatshops and so on, where workers are told that they are going to be fired if they organize a union or if they complain about the workforce or if they're put on any sort of blacklist. Does that sort of thing exist in China as well?
Yes. It's, of course, much worse. In China, I mean, of course, there is no freedom of the press or religious freedoms or any kind of freedom, intellectual freedom. There's certainly no freedom to organize. So many workers in China have no idea what an independent union is. They're quite young. They don't know the great history of China. Many workers think a union is a breakfast meeting. They have no idea because they've stomped it out. And so the workers feel in a trap. There's no place to turn. I mean, here they're producing goods for the largest retailer in the world. Here they're producing goods in this factory year after year, and their rights are being systematically violated on a routine basis with complete impunity. Walmart does what it wants. Then Walmart says to the North American people, look, we've got a code of conduct. Trust us. We respect human rights and women's rights and the rights of young people and the rights of workers, and we're going to monitor our factories. But, of course, the monitoring visits that Walmart does are a complete sham. The visits are announced in advance. They come, they show up after a 10-day advance notice. They're there for one day. Usually it's one person. Now Walmart's bragging they're sending two people out. They go into the factory. The factory's all prepared. It's been cleaned. The dangerous chemicals have been hidden. I've got our foods in the cafeteria. And every single worker knows if they say one single word of truth about that factory, they'll be fired the minute the monitors walk out the door. So the whole thing is a game. So Walmart with the mouth, is talking about human rights. But in reality, what Walmart does, and as the largest retailer in the world, they're leading this race to the bottom. Their focus exclusively on constantly slashing production costs is leading to wages being lowered all across the developing world, wages which are already below subsistence level levels. These workers are being driven deeper into misery, working longer hours. They have absolutely no rights. You're talking about 80-hour work weeks and the denial of every fundamental human, women's, and worker rights. This is why we're saying that the bargains that Walmart offers, these are bargains of misery. And if the Canadian people and the American people, the people in the United States, if they could see with their own eyes what's going on and put a human face on this bargain, they wouldn't want it. They'd walk away from it.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I'm wondering also, I mean, since you said there's been no response whatsoever, what about now that the report has been released? Has Walmart responded whatsoever? Or again, they just really don't care and they can do whatever they want?
Well, they've changed public relations firms, so now they respond a little bit because they're under increasing pressure. In the past, we found a factory in China called Kangxi, which was making women's pocketbooks for Walmart. This is like going back a few years, 2000, I believe it was. And the workers there were being forced to work from 7 o'clock in the morning to 11 o'clock at night, 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, for an average wage of 3 cents an hour. For the official 98-hour work week, they got paid $2.94. When we released that report, Walmart said that we were lying. They never used that factory. It was completely baloney, and we were just making it up. And they would have gotten away with it, except a very radical journal came to us called Business Week, and they said, do you mind if we follow up on that factory? We gave them our contacts. They went to the factory in the south of China. Of course Walmart was in the factory. They confirmed everything we said. In fact, we left out child labor and routine beatings in our report. And when Business Week went back to Walmart, went back to Jay Allen, the vice president of Walmart for communications, and they just said to him, look, why were you lying? Of course you're in that factory. And he said, well, we were lying because we're defensive about the sweatshop issue. So here you have the largest company in the world flat out lying to the people of North America. But I think Walmart's been caught enough times that in the response to these reports, Walmart just says, yes, we're in those factories. They don't lie anymore because they know we can nail them. So they say, yes, we're in those factories, but we've worked with our contractors and we're sure we've made all the improvements. That the rights of the workers are being respected now, and you just have to trust us. It's the same thing over and over again. And what we've said to Walmart, if your factories are so good, and your monitoring is so good, and your code of conduct is so good, then why don't you release to the Canadian people just the names and addresses of the factories in China that make the goods you want the people in Canada to buy? That would be a very simple step, very doable step. You could do it with the press of a finger, print out the factory list. What are you trying to hide? And Walmart to this day, of course, refuses to release even the names and addresses of those factories because it's easier and more convenient for Walmart to exploit the rights of teenage women who are locked behind barbed wire in hidden factories across China. That's easy. So right now, what you have out of Walmart is just public relations. There is, in our experience with Walmart, not just in China, but in Haiti and in Bangladesh and many other countries, there essentially is no commitment whatsoever to human rights or women's rights or to the rights of children. None. Zero. This thing is driven by just this race to the bottom, slashing production costs, putting other people out of business, driving costs down constantly, so that their focus is really just on lowering wages and rolling back respect for human, women's, and worker rights all across the world. And frankly, Walmart this year, our estimate, they'll import from China. They're the largest importer in the world of goods made in China. They're going to import $25, $26 billion worth of goods this year made in China.
We're speaking with Charles Kernaghan of the National Labor Committee. He is joining us by telephone from New York. We're speaking about the report and the findings of the National Labor Committee along with the China Labor Watch vis-a-vis Walmart's practices in China. Charles Kernaghan, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you very much for doing this.
Have
thank
a good
you.
Day.
Thank you.
And now for Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Mel Goodman, former CIA analyst and senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, who assesses how Iraq's recent parliamentary elections may affect the war and U.S. occupation. Greg Rollins, a member of the Christian Peacemaker team living in Iraq, discusses how his group has responded to the kidnapping of four of his colleagues. And Kit Gage, director of the First Amendment Foundation, who looks at press reports and President Bush's admission that his administration has, in violation of federal law, spied on U.S. citizens without court authorization. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In a speech celebrating Human Rights Day, United Nations Human Rights Commissioner Louise Arbour declared the global ban on torture had become a victim of the war on terrorism. Arbour, a former Canadian Supreme Court justice, identified two odious practices, rendition, or the practice of transferring suspects to a court where they are likely to be tortured, and holding prisoners in secret detention. John Bolton, the American ambassador to the UN, blasted Arbour, saying it was inappropriate and illegitimate for an international civil servant to second-guess the conduct the U.S. has been engaged in the war on terror. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan quickly defended his human rights chief and pledged to bring up the topic directly with Bolton. Arbour's address on the theme of torturers and terrorists was given 3 days before Human Rights Day, celebrated on December 10th, the day in 1948 the UN ratified the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The 1994 UN Treaty on Torture prohibits certain practices that do not meet the legal definition of torture. Included are techniques that human rights groups say the U.S. has used at its detention center in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Arbour urged the Bush administration to allow each detainee the right to an attorney of their choice and free access to American courts. Led by progressive evangelical Jim Wallace, editor of Sojourners, a Christian journal, hundreds of members of mainline church denominations like the United Church of Christ and the United Methodist Church protested proposed cuts to the poor in the 2006 federal budget in front of a congressional office building. Before Congress left for Christmas break, they approved $42 billion in cuts over 5 years with reductions in Medicare and student loans. Food stamp funding was preserved. Wallace told the Washington Post, "The leaders of the religious right were withholding their opposition to the budget cuts in exchange for support for socially conservative judges." Meanwhile, Congress has pushed through billions of dollars in tax cuts for America's wealthiest citizens. Acting GOP House Majority Leader Roy Blunt, Republican of Missouri, countered that lowering taxes on investors will boost the economy and improve the lives of poor people. Tony Perkins, head of the Family Research Council, says defending welfare benefits is less vital than halting human slavery. While agreeing that there is a biblical mandate to take care of the poor, Perkins maintains that the Bible doesn't say government should do it. Nearly 30 years after he wrote the first lethal injection law in the country, former Oklahoma state legislator Bill Wiseman has regrets. "I am sorry for what I did," Wiseman recently told Mother Jones magazine. "I hope someday to offset it by helping us realize that capital punishment is wrong and self-destructive." As a young politician in the mid-70s, Wiseman, who attended a Quaker school as a teenager, wanted to make the newly reimposed death penalty in conservative Oklahoma more humane. He worked with the state medical examiner Jay Chapman on creating a liquid drip to induce death. The system was later adopted by 37 states and is now the most widely used method for executing death row inmates. Over the last 20 years, over 800 people were killed with lethal injection versus 168 people using other means like the electric chair or the gas chamber. Opponents of the death penalty are now trying to make the case that lethal injection is cruel and unusual punishment. A recent study in the scientific journal The Lancet looked at medical reports of executed inmates in four states. Those killed by lethal injection had a lower level of anesthetic than required for surgery. If a prisoner is conscious during the execution, the pain from potassium chloride, the agent used in lethal injections, is similar to boiling oil or a branding iron. Wiseman, who is now an ordained Anglican priest, says, "The problem is that we're killing people. That's what's wrong, not how we're doing it." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
Iraq's December 15th parliamentary election saw an estimated 11 million Iraqis cast ballots for representatives that will form a new four-year government. President Bush touted the success of the election, which was conducted with reduced levels of violence and the participation of large numbers of Sunni Muslims that had largely boycotted prior votes. Early returns indicated that with two-thirds of the votes counted, the main Shiite religious party coalition with strong ties to Iran would dominate any new government. The party of Mr. Bush's ally, former Prime Minister Ayad Alawi, was trailing behind a Sunni coalition party that supports resistance to the occupation and a withdrawal of American forces. In a December 18th televised address to a nation increasingly opposed to the war, President Bush asked for patience and resolve in fighting insurgents in Iraq, but failed to lay out any timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. troops. While acknowledging some disagreements about his decision to launch the war, Mr. Bush went on to label some of his critics as defeatists. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with former CIA analyst Mel Goodman, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. He assesses Iraq's recent parliamentary election and how it may affect the war and U.S. occupation.
I think what the administration has done for various, fairly obvious reasons, is to oversell the importance of this election. But at the same time, the critics of the war, and I've been a strong critic of the war before there was a war, have to acknowledge that to hold an election and have 10 million people vote is important, just as it was in Moscow in 1989. But as we've seen, the problem in the Soviet Union came after 1989, and I'm afraid the problems in Iraq are going to come after this election in 2005. So we're going to know some things fairly soon.
Mel Goodman, one of the points President Bush made in his speech was that the overthrow of Saddam Hussein and the war against the insurgents will produce a strong ally for the United States in the future in the very critical area of the Middle East. But there are many analysts who look at the probable makeup of a new Iraqi government after these elections that may very well be strongly aligned with the nation of Iran, labeled by this president as part of the axis of evil. What do you see down the line in terms of the probability that we're going to have a Shia-controlled government there that is very friendly with the mullahs in Tehran?
Well, there's an inherent contradiction in everything that President Bush says. On the one hand, he talks about democracy, that we're going to democratize Iraq. Well, you're looking at a country that's over 60% Shia. So it stands to reason that if democracy really takes in Iraq, you're going to see a Shia government. If you look at the Shia leadership in turn, then you find out that virtually every major Shia leader, every major cleric, every leader of a military a group that's independent of the Iraqi National Army, either was educated in Iran, born in Iran, grew up in Iran, spent some formative years in Iran, has serious patrons in Iran. So therefore, not only is it obvious that we're going to get a Shia government of one type or another, but it's most likely that we will get a Shia government that's aligned with Iran. Now, if we've overthrown Saddam Hussein and deployed 160,000 American servicemen and women in Iraq and spent over $250 billion in addition to what's in the defense budget, to have a Shia government align with Iran to form a very strong Islamic coalition in the Persian Gulf, I can't think of a more disastrous situation for American national security interests. granted, Saddam Hussein was an extremely evil figure and a figure of incredible discontinuity in the Middle East. But there are certain things he kept a lid on, and one was terrorism and insurgency in his own country. And he wasn't a threat to the United States in terms of his support for terrorism. He had nothing to do with 9/11. He had no links to al-Qaeda. He had no personal relationship with Osama bin Laden. Now, instead of Saddam Hussein, we're going to have this Shia government with ties to Iran, and the problems for the United States will just begin in a very serious way. So was it worth overthrowing Saddam Hussein? Well, I'd say it's good that he's not around, but the price was far too much. We've paid too much in terms of treasure, we've paid too much in terms of blood, and we've paid too much in terms of the stability of American national security policy. I just can't approve of the kind of price that we're paying. And for this to be called a victory under any circumstances becomes essentially rather ludicrous.
What do you see as the tipping point for a full-blown civil war in Iraq, if it's not already ongoing, in your view?
Well, I think we're already seeing the signs of civil war. So I don't know if there's any real tipping point. A lot of people feel the tipping point would be an American withdrawal, that that's what would lead Iraq to engage in full-blown civil war. But I think Iraqis know full well what happened in the Balkans after the demise of Tito, and they certainly know what happened in Lebanon in the wake of this Syrian involvement in Lebanon and the Israeli intervention in Lebanon in the early 1980s. And I do think they want to avoid those situations. And that's why I think if we announced a timely withdrawal over a protracted period, it would give them time to get their own house in order and to work more effectively at using the wonderful middle class that Iraq was developing over the last 20 years, as well as the excellent bureaucracy that they had, because they had a more interesting infrastructure in Iraq than most other Arab countries in the Middle East. And it would be reason to get their house in order to prepare for that day when the United States was going to leave. The longer we stay, the longer they have the notion that the United States will do these things for them. The United States will take up the military challenge because that's what they're there for, and the Iraqis don't have to bother with this. So I think some sign of U.S. Withdrawal would be the clear signal and maybe the tipping point in an opposite direction to get people prepared for trying to create some stabilization index in Iraq, and that's what needs to take place.
Should the United States, and maybe it's already occurring, should the United States be engaged in diplomatic negotiations with the insurgent groups in Iraq to prepare for a U.S. withdrawal?
Oh, I think the United States should be working as aggressively at this as anything else they're doing. It's very important to reach out to the insurgents. I'm not talking about the terrorists. I'm not talking about Zarqawi, but I'm talking about the insurgents. I'm talking about impressing those people who are former Ba'athists to make it clear to them that the United States doesn't want access to the oil holdings in the country. The United States doesn't want access to the permanent bases because we are building 14 major military facilities in this country, and we've never disavowed an interest in these military bases for our own permanent presence. All this has to be signaled to the insurgents, and at the same time, the majority Shia community must understand that it's important for the Sunni minority to have some hope for some viable political role in this new nation. I think that is essential, and I think it would be the threat of violence and a worsening of violence that could lead all of the sides in this very complicated equation to come to the table and maybe negotiate some of these differences.
That was Mel Goodman, a former CIA analyst and senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Contact the center by calling area code 202-232-3317 or visit their website at www.ciponline.org. On November 26th, four long-term volunteers with the Christian Peacemaker Team in Iraq were kidnapped by a group calling itself the Swords of Righteousness Brigade. The kidnappers threatened to kill the four men, two Canadians, an American, and a Briton, if the U.S. and Britain did not release all Iraqi prisoners they hold. Deadlines have come and gone, but the kidnappers, as of the date of this report, have not yet carried out their threat. Since 1984, CPT has sent teams to conflict zones around the world, employing direct action to reduce violence and protect human rights. Members of the CPT in Iraq have responded to President George Bush's call to stay the course in Iraq by calling on the U.S. to pull its military out of the occupied nation. They also remind the world that kidnapping has affected far more Iraqis than it has foreigners. And they say this lack of security is directly related to the ongoing military occupation of Iraq. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Greg Rollins, a Canadian who has lived in Iraq almost 3 years. Speaking from Baghdad, he describes the day-to-day work of the Christian peacemaker teams, how the group has responded to the kidnappings of their colleagues, and the impact the foreign military occupation has had on ordinary Iraqis.
Daily life for us pretty much consists of doing our work. Usually it is talking with Iraqis, meeting with Iraqis to discuss, you know, human rights work or human rights violations, or working with organizations to maybe do some sort of demonstration, work on a demonstration, or go to the city of Fallujah to document, you know, stuff that's been happening there or is happening there. Or it can be working with people who are trying to find loved ones who have been arrested by U.S. and or Iraqi forces, or I should say multinational forces instead of just U.S. forces. And so sometimes we end up going to military bases with them or going to a ministry office to try and track down their loved one who was arrested and hasn't been heard from since.
I understand that people from the Christian peacemaker teams have a good working relationship with many Iraqis. Can you just describe a little bit about how Iraqis on the street view you?
Whenever we first meet Iraqis, they are a little suspicious or uncertain about who we are. We do carry a sheet with us in Arabic and in English that explains who we are and who we are not, and it explains what we do and what we don't do. And from that, Iraqis get a very good picture or idea of, you know, who we are and what we're trying to achieve. But we do have very good relations with the people that we work with because they have the same goals and the same objectives that we do, you know, trying to work on things through nonviolence and trying to expose or document or make known the human rights abuses that are happening here.
Were you surprised when your four colleagues were kidnapped? Do you feel relatively safe there because of the work you're doing, or do you feel like your lives are in danger all the time?
Well, no, we weren't surprised when our colleagues were taken. I mean, we were shocked, but that's because the actual, you know, that's something you go through when this first happens. But to say that we never imagined it would happen to us would be kind of foolish because we always said, you know, we're no more different than anybody else. We're foreigners, and just by being foreigners here, you are eligible for being a target. Do I feel any different? Well, I feel a little different now that it's happened, but the same as before it happened. I'm not going to let that fear control me, or I'm not going to let my apprehension control my actions. At the same time, I'm not going to be reckless and go running into places that I shouldn't go if my friends tell me not to, or if I don't feel it's a good idea.
Greg Rollins, your organization has reached out to everyone you can think of to try to help convince the kidnappers to release your colleagues. Can you say anything more specific about how that's gone, what you've done, and what you're still planning to do?
Well, what we've done is we've asked a lot of our Iraqi work partners and friends to write statements on our behalf and try and get them on as much media, Iraqi media, as possible, as well as, you know, we've put them up on our website in English and in Arabic. And we've asked the same of a lot of our friends throughout the Middle East, in Jordan and in Palestine, because we have a team in Palestine as well. And throughout the world, whether they be Muslim or Christian or secular groups or whatever kind of groups, we've asked, you know, for their support. And you know, our hope is that seeing this, those who took our colleagues will, you know, reconsider what they've done and hopefully let them go and just release them so that we can continue doing our work.
Do you have any opinion about the December 15th elections? Do you think the fact that they went pretty smoothly will have any bearing on the release of your colleagues?
I'm not sure what bearing the elections will have on the safety of my colleagues or the release of my colleagues. It's hard to say. The group that has taken them hasn't really said enough for us to get a picture of that. As for the elections themselves, well, I was happy that they went off smoothly without any problems. I was happy to see a good turnout. But what remains to be seen is what kind of government will be formed.
Finally, do you have any sense from your work whether the number of Iraqis arrested and imprisoned has increased, decreased, or stayed about the same over the past several months?
at the end of this month, I'm not sure exactly when, but at the end of this month, the U.S. Army will be opening a fourth prison here in Iraq. It'll be in the north. I'm not sure what the name of it is, but it was projected that by the end of this year, the U.S. forces, or multinational forces, sorry, would be able to hold up to 16,000 prisoners. So I would say from that that the amount of people being imprisoned is rising.
That was Greg Rollins of the Christian Peacemaker Team in Iraq. Contact the group by calling area code 773-277-0253 or visit their website at www.cpt.org. A political firestorm is gathering in Washington after the New York Times published a story on December 16th revealing that President Bush in 2002 had secretly authorized the National Security Agency to spy on American citizens through electronic eavesdropping, bypassing a federal law requiring court-approved warrants. The surveillance of international phone calls and email was purportedly conducted to identify terrorist groups and prevent attacks. The New York Times delayed reporting on the story for a year after the White House requested that it not be published. Many congressional Democrats, some Republicans, and civil liberties advocates maintain that the president has violated a 1978 federal law that mandates that all electronic monitoring be approved by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. Separately, documents obtained by the ACLU under a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit confirm that the FBI has been spying on U.S. environmental, religious, and animal rights groups such as Greenpeace, PETA, and Catholic workers' communities. In response to the NSA spy story, Mr. Bush confirmed his approval of surveillance without court warrants and vowed to continue the practice. The president asserted that government monitoring of citizens was authorized by a 2001 congressional resolution to use all necessary force against terrorists responsible for the 9/11 attacks. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Kit Gage, director of the First Amendment Foundation, who explains why she believes President Bush's action is a grave violation of the U.S. Constitution and represents an impeachable offense.
I think this is a fabulous civics lesson, because it gets to the balance of powers, it gets to the role of the Congress and the courts, and it underscores the critical nature of how this country was founded with three branches of government to try to make sure that we don't have a dictatorship. Mr. Bush has admitted that he has authorized the National Security Agency, NSA, to wiretap communications from U.S. persons, which can be citizens or non-citizens, from the U.S. to other countries and vice versa. This isn't what we think of the NSA doing, which is sort of keyword intercepts, but rather regular old wiretaps. The government has a really long history of abusing people's rights and abusing technology. The NSA was spying on Vietnam War dissenters in the 60s and 70s, as part of the Nixon administration's authorizations. And that blew up in Nixon's face, and the result was the FISA law, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which created a court, the FISA court, which the government was required to use, not in criminal investigations, but in terrorism kinds of investigations, at that point during the Cold War, but it's really a direct connection to the terrorism investigations. You had to go to that court to get permission to do wiretaps of people you thought had a connection to foreign power. That's been expanded to do terrorism wiretaps. So there has been this modification to recognize that we're in a different technological era. But nonetheless, Mr. Bush said and has now stated publicly that he signed, repeatedly signed, every 45 days, signed an executive order to violate, to intentionally violate the FISA Act and order the NSA to do these wiretaps. And he apparently told a couple people in Congress, although they're now saying, some of them are saying that they weren't told the extent of this. But he didn't go to the Congress and say, you know, I don't have enough authority under FISA. You need to give me more authority so that I can do emergency wiretaps. He didn't do that. He just blatantly violated the law and quite clearly the Constitution, violating the, which tells it that the government cannot do searches without due process.
Kit Gage, President Bush justifies what he did in terms of bypassing the FISA courts by saying the post-9/11 world is a very dangerous place and he had to do what he had to do in order to protect this country. There are many people in this nation that may very well believe that. But what is the danger of a president having unchecked powers to spy on Americans or to render civilians in this country or other countries to secret prisons and to employ torture and all the other things we've seen throughout this Bush presidency?
You're right. It raises the same kinds of concerns. There's only one way that people have, ordinary folks, you and me, to make sure that our government doesn't become a dictatorship, and that is to hold it to the Constitution, to the Bill of Rights, and to the law. You know, when a president, as Mr. Bush has just very explicitly done, says, we're at an endless war on terror, and that gives me the authority to secretly violate the law and violate the Constitution, you know, with the exception of when people start leaking this information, it gives us no ability to stop that unharnessed power. And if now, when this has become public, if the Congress doesn't hold hearings and pass a law telling the president he can't do this, and if the courts don't opine in the same way, then it's going to be really hard to uphold the Constitution in this whole area. And not only that, it's going to be a scary place when the president can set that kind of a precedent and not be held accountable by the Congress or the courts.
What happens next, Kit Gage? What can the Congress do? What should the Congress do to check this seeming abuse of presidential power?
Well, they certainly need to get a bunch of questions answered. It looks like some of the questions are being answered. Mr. Bush is admitting a lot of this stuff. We need to understand what the rationale is from the Attorney General and who else authorized this. And I would argue if this turns out to be as serious as it looks today, I think that's an impeachable offense. I don't see any way around it. If the president says, you know, he has intentionally violated a constitutionally grounded law, and the argument is, you know, I'm violating it because we all figured out that they wouldn't let me do what I wanted to do, you know, that is a direct violation of what he's sworn to do. And, you know, and I think it's going to be interesting to see what this Congress does with this information, because it's spying on people is recognized by both the right and the left, not to mention various folks in the middle, as being a really serious problem.
That was Kit Gage, director of the First Amendment Foundation. Contact the foundation by calling area code 202-529-4225 or visit their website at www.firstamend.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Joanne Paradise, and Damon Thomas. We welcome and need your participation, too. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Tune in next Saturday, New Year's Eve, from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We'll be looking back at 2005, plus featuring interviews with people from the independent media. We leave you with these words of wisdom from Jesus Christ. Live your lives, doing towards others as you would have them do to you.